Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It's March 4th. No, it's April 4th. And we missed last week because we were out of town.
We didn't miss it. You put your setting up your talk up.
Yeah, but I did it like 3 days late, so it doesn't, count.
Not really. People liked it. Yeah. I have a cold.
You have a bad cold.
It's not as bad as it was yesterday, which is really horrible. Yeah, I had to preach because no one else. I mean, I had written a sermon for that Sunday.
And you finished Philippians.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really great.
Yeah, and we finished Philippians, and so I couldn't let. I mean, I kind of had to preach, and it felt like I was going to sneeze like the whole time I was preaching. And I didn't. I didn't sneeze. I didn't blow my nose.
The Lord was with you.
Yeah. So, I don't know how it. But as soon as I got down from the pulpit, it like immediately all the pressure to sneeze came back. I had to go out in the back each time.
Well, you also stayed away from people.
I did. I didn't. I let you guys pass out communion, and I just. And your dad celebrated. But that was really horrible. I got home and I was exhausted. And, yeah, it was.
I mean, I do feel very bad for you. It's the first time you've been sick in 3 years. But, and the reason I'm being so sympathetic is because for the last 3 years, you've been explaining to everyone that you never get sick.
I don't. I
if
don't
only
get sick.
You
this
had,
is the first time.
If only you had not said that so often, then.
You. I was not. The only reason I got sick this time is because. Well, I forgot to take Limit. I've been taking Limit every night. Two things of Limit every night. Water, Limit water, or Limit whiskey.
Yeah.
Depending on the night. And I stopped doing that for Lent. And
so God smote
you.
So
God, this is why
you
should never give up whiskey.
You should never observe Lent.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so sad that you're sick because it's just such a huge inconvenience to me when you are not well. So, but
it was, I mean, I think that colds hit men harder than they do women.
I don't think that's true.
There's something within the physiology of the male body that makes colds like super much more, super
worse. I think it's
worse
the
than,
psychology of the man, not the physiology that, right? Because women get bad colds, but they just soldier on because
you don't know what it's like to be a man with a cold. You have no idea.
That's true. I know. You're right. I could try identifying. Next time I get a cold, I'm going to self-identify as a man, and that'll help me know what it's like.
You shouldn't talk about that of which you have no experience.
So,
if you were a man with a cold, you wouldn't get out of bed.
You'd have to, well, that's you'd, obviously you'd
true. Because it would hurt you worse.
So, well, we don't have very much to talk about. You want to talk about Disney, don't you?
I do. You don't want to talk about them.
No, go ahead. But what did you want to say about Disney?
Well, it's very bad. Well, not just Disney. I was because we were talking yesterday in our Sunday night. This is another thing I had to like, keep myself from sneezing all over everybody. And during Christian Ed, because we're working our way very slowly through the Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self.
How far are you?
We finished chapter 3 yesterday after 8 weeks.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, there's a long chapters. There's a long chapters.
Yeah. And there's now, so much
and
in then, them.
And there's so much, and so next week we're gonna do the poetry chapter. But anyway, the whole idea of the book is that he's trying to investigate why we think of the self the way we do. Why I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, or vice versa.
Why you're
makes sense. Because if you said that to our great grandfathers, they would either laugh or not understand what you're talking about. But even if you disagree with it, you understand what that means. And so he talks about the kind of triumph of what Philip Reeve calls the psychological man, where we identify ourselves with what's within, and an expressive individualism, where we say to be fully authentic requires that the self identity that you define by looking within yourself is expressed outwardly, and everything around you needs to be conformed to that outward expression of your inner self. And so chapter 3 is all about Rousseau and his influence on that, and how he's really the one that said your inner self is your true self, like and it's good, like the inner source of you
it's society that corrupts you.
The reason there's evil, the reason bad things happen, the reason people steal things, the reason people act in bad ways is because society has corrupted the true inner self. And you wouldn't have envy, you wouldn't have desire to dominate, you wouldn't have the desire to be more beautiful or better than someone else if it weren't for the way society was structured. So the way to get to a better society is for the individual to look within and tap into the authentic self and live in accordance with that. And then if society could all be restructured so that a person could do that, people would do that. That would be, you'd kind of create a utopian world. And Rousseau had this idea that all human nature was the same. So the virtue of the inner self is something that God has given. It's uncorrupted. He didn't believe in a fall.
Did he believe in God?
He did believe in God. Okay. But maybe, I guess he's more of a
deist.
Right. But the inner self is something that is light. So we all have equal, the virtues that God gave humanity are the same. So we would all, if we all lived out our inner selves, it wouldn't be like a bunch of 10 billion people living out their own individual lives. It'd be everybody living according to the common human nature that God gave us.
It's like a proto, if you know better, you do better kind of. Like that was the first inching towards that.
But then Truman was saying, well, okay, that you lose that idea of a common human nature, and then, but you keep the idea of the inner self being the arbiter of truth and virtue, then you have chaos because you don't have a common, there's no common virtue that everyone thinks they agrees. Should have, right? Exactly. And that's what's happened. So anyway, back to Disney, these people, and public educators who want to teach 3-year-olds about sex, and teach them to look within themselves to decide whether or not they're a boy or a girl, not at their bodies, at their
psyches.
Their psyches. That's straight. That you would not be able to do that without Rousseau. It wouldn't be that Rousseau set the groundwork for that kind of thing. and these people think they're, think they're helping these children flourish.
I mean, do they really think that, or are they just so? Because when I've watched a lot of TikTok videos, actually, libs of TikTok on Twitter, cuts TikTok videos in, and you can watch people freaking out about not just about the very idea that they wouldn't be allowed to say whatever they wanted to at their job, to young children. And it doesn't, not very many of them are expressing particular interest in the children. Like, it's very much that they want to be known. It's very important for them to be known by the children. And it's important, like, the children, they, of course, very, very Glennon Doyle. Like, you could say the unlived life of the teacher is the most painful thing for the children in the classroom. She says that about, who said that? Not Freud, but Carl Jung. The unlived life of the mother is the most painful thing for the child, which is absolute malarkey.
Yeah, our children were always saying, Mom, Dad, why aren't you filling yourself more?
I want to know. I want you to live your life. And so that is now like the kindergarten, not even the mother now, it's the kindergarten teacher. The unlived life of the kindergarten teacher is the most painful thing for the children in the classroom. As if, really, as if they care. But that's what they express in these videos.
Well, right. So I'm not saying that they, that's really an honest assessment of what they're doing.
Okay.
I'm saying that's what they say they're doing.
That's what they say.
They probably tell themselves that's what they're doing.
Right. They believe at some level that that's what they're doing.
They're helping these children flourish by helping them tap into their true selves. And their parents don't know, who are bigoted, won't let them think about sex in an open way. And so you can't let the parents in the process. You have to do this kind of secretly. So if your third grader says, I'm really a woman and it's a man, then, you know, you can begin to help him identify that way by calling him her, and at least while at school. Yeah. And then you don't tell the parents, right? Because that's betraying that kid's self. And so you build these little enclaves of grooming children for sexual perversion. And now a number of states are saying you can't do that. State legislatures are saying, okay, we're going to put a stop to this, and they're bad, right? So first of all, they're saying we're not grooming children, but you better not pass a law that
keeps us from grooming children.
Right. And then Disney started building up their magical kingdom, whatever the heck it was, in Florida, they were given a whole bunch of license by the state, like no regulation. They basically had their own little country going on,
in like the Vatican,
in Disney World. And so DeSantis, who I think, man, he's awesome, but DeSantis, he's gonna he wants to pull that special status away from them, which is great. And they're like David French, up comes David French, of course, who says, oh no, conservatives should not be for more government regulation. Like, so he's defending this like company of groomers.
But we can't have we can have regulation in every other realm of life. Like, we have so much regulation about
things. I'm all for low regulation, but the basic core responsibility of a government is to protect its citizens. Like, so if a private company says, oh yeah, we're going to start gassing Jews, but it's the First Amendment right. The government says, no, that's murder, and we're going to take your license away. Or if a company says, we're going to start abusing children sexually, and it's a private company, so we get the right to do that. No. You don't have the right to do that. That's not a First Amendment right. Like, Disney does not have the right to groom children just because it's a private company. That's not a First Amendment right. That was literally David French's argument. It's a First Amendment right for Disney to groom children. But he's also the same guy who celebrated the gay story hour or whatever it is at the libraries. Remember that? I'm glad to live in a country where this is, where people are free to
again,
have
that shouldn't have been a First Amendment right. The library should not have been able to have
something wrong with that guy.
Grown men.
It's just, really, I mean, he thinks it's fine. He thinks it's good to have a library where children are groomed.
Because
a public library.
It doesn't mean that if somebody is telling the children all about these kinds of things, that person is going to be the one to abuse them. But it might not be. But that person is preparing the way for other people to come along and sexually abuse children, that child in particular.
I mean, if you take away the Christian aspect of it, that's what's happening. The Christian aspect of it is, they're also destroying their souls.
Well, yeah. But,
take away that and you say, okay, because we have to live in this weirdly, quote-unquote, secular society where everyone's being indoctrinated into quote unquote secularism, which really means
nothing or godlessness
or whatever. But even take that away, it's still like you're putting kids in a position where they're being taught how to one day possibly mutilate their bodies
or be sexually abused.
Or be sexually abused,
like,
right.
we spend so much time in the church making sure that our sexual abuse stuff is up to date, because it's actually a really, really big deal. Protecting children from predators and bad things is one of the most important things that we do. So what we'll just, and I, you know, it's interesting that that was a shared cultural value until the beginning of this year. That it was a shared assumption that has gone away in what, like a month?
Yeah.
It's really shocking that we don't share that value in this culture, which
it shouldn't be shocking. Is it like as much as it is? When you look at like the originators of queer theory, June Butler, Judith Butler, and Michel Foucault, these are pedophiles. They in their writings, or they advocate for, you know, man boy love.
Well, Judith Butler is a woman.
Yeah, well, she advocates for this. There's an article that came out over the weekend, I think it was. Showing that, you know, the ones, the root of queer theory is the idea of adult men and young women, or I'm sorry, young men and older women and younger women. That's part and parcel of the whole idea. And so why is anyone surprised about this?
Well, because I keep hoping that God will, I'm I, in a sort of a fatuous way, keep wishing that God would stop the spread.
I just think it's, I think it's
2 weeks to stop the spread of Disney.
I think it's a huge lie for the quote unquote LGBTQ community to start to pretend that it's against pedophilia, because it really isn't. I mean, there might be some, there are probably individuals who are not for that thing, but part of the gay, at least the gay male outlook, has always been the younger the better. That's why, you know, I was reading another article this weekend. You know why models, fashion models,
yeah, well, in I've France, been to say this my whole life and nobody ever listened,
well, let's
to
say
me
it.
Until
let's
5
say
me
it.
Now.
Right, let's say so why I used to look at these models coming out down the runway and thought, they have no curves. There's like no femaleness about them. And there's a purpose for that, because all those designs were gay and they're trying to make the women look like young men.
Yeah, I mean, that's why women have to wear the clothes of 12-year-old boys. Middle-aged women who have given birth a lot of times, who are now not only called breeders, but bleeders, which is so offensive. I can't even have to wear the clothes of 12-year-old boys because men hate women. I mean, it really is. It's a deep core hatred of the female body, and the trans ideology, mm-hmm. and homosexual. I mean, reading that book, Queer Marriage by the Kalofs, you know, they say with their mouths, oh, we respect women, but
women are competition.
But yeah, men, gay men, it, in a deep way, utterly reject femaleness, which is why the T is so funny, because it blows up the biological thing. Like, it's insane, but it somehow all holds together. Yeah. And I do think that hatred of women is at the core of it.
While we're on this topic, and you're saying uncontroversial things, should we just like address the idea that two gay men living together in a quote unquote celibate relationship? I'm saying quote unquote a lot, aren't I? Know more about friendship than.
I mean, you could, but you could let me save that, because I haven't finished the book, and I
Okay, can I give a preview of what we might say after you finish the book?
I guess like, so. Like, just, you're gonna
assuming that people with fundamentally disordered sexual desires are going to teach people without fundamentally disordered sexual desires how to be friends is absurd. The idea that two men who really want to have sex together, but they're restraining themselves and being celibate, and you know, whatever, confessing their lusts, that desire to be together is going to teach everyone else about friendship, which is what the spiritual friendship movement suggests, and what Revoy suggests, is absurd. The problem is,
teach other people about marriage too,
and teach other
people
about marriage.
That's what the description of marriage. What the description of marriage and friendship, both in just the beginning of this book, illuminates that the author does not know, cannot properly describe what those two things are. Because they are wrongly articulated right off the page. And if married people accept those definitions of marriage and friendship, they will then enter into something that is disordered themselves, even if they don't have those inclinations.
I mean, I was just kind of shocked at the cover of the book by Wes Hill. I mean, the whole idea of, again, two men living together and
he hasn't said that yet. I mean, now you haven't gotten that
far. But he does promote this.
In the
spiritual friendship is all about this, like men forming communities or partnerships even, where you take vows and you don't, you live celibately, which is great. I'm glad they're doing that. And then this is supposed to be a model for Christian friendship.
It is so naive.
Right. But
there's like layers of problems. It's very deeply naive because you're asking people to believe things about human
nature that aren't true.
And then you're also having a definition, a description of friendship and marriage that is not proper to what.
Right. But see, a homosexual desire in itself is a perversion. There's lots of perversions. Everyone has perversions of some sort in their souls because we're fallen. But we're not supposed to live to press into those. Those perversions aren't things that help us see how to live better. So when someone is struggling under a disordered affection, you don't look to that person to help us understand what friendship is about. That's not a good aspect of nature. It's a ruined aspect of nature, which Jesus can heal, and you know, Jesus forgives those people and loves those people if they're Christians. But we don't need to look to that as a model for friendship. I mean, I'm gonna pick some woman from church or from life, and I'm gonna have a spiritual friendship with her. We're gonna take vows. And then we're going to live together. You're going to stay here. And we're going to live together.
I just read a great book. This Miss Mole book, the book was really interesting. But the author I read about, so she was married. So this book was published in the 30s. But she was married. Her husband died. So she moved in with a man and his wife. But she was carrying on an affair. It was kind of like, didn't Bart do this? And she became a permanent part of their household for years and years and years. And they called her, like, because the wife was there, like, they kept up this pretense that she was just sort of... But she was having an affair with a man. It was really... and the book is... Well, it's an interesting book. Miss Mole's a novel, but that doesn't happen in the novel. It's just the... so no, you're not doing that. Sorry to burst your bubble, but that's not going to be a thing that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't think that would be something that Christians should do. I mean, like, I wouldn't... That wouldn't give me more insight into friendship with a woman.
No, it wouldn't. That's for sure. It would not
give even me... Even if I managed not to have any kind of sexual desire for that person, it wouldn't give me any more insight into friendship than you and I's relationship together would.
Yeah.
Which they say, don't they say is corrupted by, our friendship is corrupted by sexual desire? Or if you're married to somebody, it's not real friendship?
They're building the, like, you know, modern marriage can't bear the weight of friendship. You know, modern marriage has too many expectations put on it. That's all the things that are happening right now. And so we should look to other cultures that have, you know, men being friends with each other and women being friends with each other. And I get, the problem with a lot of Westerners saying that, I think, is that a lot of people in the U.S. who make that, those kinds of, who feel nostalgic about, you know, maybe Middle Eastern culture or where I grew up, African culture in West Africa, is that they have never experienced that. Like, that's not their lived experience at all. And so they think it looks really great, but they don't know that those kinds of cultures have disorders within them as well. Like, men never ever expecting to be friends with their wives goes too far the other way. Sure, do you have to be, like, does your wife have to be your soulmate?
Well, in your culture, in your village, wasn't it, like, normally the case that your wife wasn't, not only was she not your best friend, but she also wasn't your lover?
Well, yeah.
You
could have, not always, but you could have, another kind of friend.
A woman who as you they had sex say, with a lot.
Another right? person.
Right. And that wasn't, because your wife was just basically there to have babies for your,
well,
for your family line, right? That
sort of is more ancient way of looking at marriage. But why, I don't know, it's interesting to me that suddenly, like, to make desire, the current modes of desire more, to justify them, we look to the ancient past or other cultures. I mean, again, though, rather than to the scriptures, which describe a kind of, describe friendship. Well, anyway, you're blowing my arc because I haven't finished the book. And
I'm just saying, if God didn't think that the wife and the husband should be one another's primary, not only romantic or whatever, I don't use that word, bond, but also friendship bond, then he would have created like two other people in the garden, right? Like another man for Adam to be friends with and another one. I mean, the original pairing is important. It tells us what God intended for the male-female relationship. And since the male-female relationship is supposed to be about God and Christ and his church, it makes sense that there wouldn't, that would be the primary, your primary human friendship would be with your spouse.
And then there are other things overlaid, you know, people go to David and Jonathan, which is very formal. Like, where I grew up, a person would be assigned a friend if they didn't have one. David and Jonathan didn't have that sort of, well, you are officially my friend, you know, which he's described warriors in England, you know, being buried together. And that you shouldn't overlay American emotionalism over that necessarily. But Hannah and Ruth are another, or not Hannah, Naomi and Ruth. That is a nice friendship. There's just, but you, anyway, that's a big rabbit hole.
Yeah. Okay. Well, wait till you finish that book. So anyway, that's my take.
Okay.
I went first, and I probably took all the oxygen. So what would you?
Well, like? I just watched, for some reason. Well, I've been wanting to for a while. I've been wanting to rewatch Love Actually, because I thought it would be really fun. I can't do it because I'm not smart enough. But I thought it would be really fun to write a novel called Church Actually. But I couldn't remember the movie Love Actually, because when I watched it, and when did it come out? Like 2003 or something?
It was like, we saw it in the theater.
A long time ago.
We heard it was really good, and it was really bad.
And we hated it. Yeah. We had that like visceral, oh my word, this is the worst thing I've ever seen feeling about the movie. And then I was really astonished in the aftermath of the movie to find out that everybody loved it. It's become a classic, and people still love it. So I can remember exactly what I hated about it. So I watched it, And it's weird to watch. It's a Christmas movie, technically. And what's interesting is that it has this vestigial sort of vapor. It's like the vapor of old love. So it includes self-sacrifice in some cases, denying yourself what you want for the sake of somebody else. That comes in. But then there's also sort of snapshots of people just taking what they want and not caring about the other person at all. And then this early, if I just, like, I'm most human, I've reached the pinnacle of happiness if I can just express how I feel to the other person. If I can just do that, even if nothing comes of it, then I will have really lived. So the expression, the sort of performance that Truman talks about, of feeling and emotion is showcased in a big way in this movie. But I remember, well, I think that's what people think is so amazing about it, that was the first, not first, but it kind of came together. And it's so depressing. It is not love. It is love, actually, like the way it is now, but it is not good or true, and it's very depressing. It's interesting to me that people love it still so much.
So people are just groping to have an experience? Is that,
to find the person they're supposed to be with, but there's an adult, like, it's really moving and terrible because Emma Thompson and I don't know Colonel Brandon. That's not whoever plays Colonel Brandon. He tries to, I guess, okay to spoil the movie 20 years in. He tries to have an affair.
Okay.
In this movie. And so they don't play that nicely. Like, he's obviously being petulant and selfish. And
they don't put it up.
They don't put it like him
finding himself.
He's obviously indulging temptation and he's not really caring about who she is. So there's that, you know, like, I don't know how they would do that anymore. I don't think you can, you know, if he wants to have an affair, he should go do that. And then another character is in love with someone, but chooses not to be with him because her brother demands all of her attention. He's in an institution and he's not okay. And so she can't manage, basically, a romantic life and taking care of her brother, and she chooses her brother, which is quite moving. But you are left wondering if she's made the right choice. Like,
oh, like the movie
sort of hangs out there. Like,
maybe she shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then, I'm trying to think, there's all these little sort of vignettes, people, you know, that they piece together. And then, of course, Hugh Grant plays the prime minister and he finds love, and the American president is the bully, and the, you know, he's Britain. Hugh Grant stands up to the American president.
British movie, right?
Yeah. And it's like, we're not going to be bullied by you. And then the music swells, or the claps, and they're all so happy. So it was interesting to go back and watch it again. What I've realized slowly is that I haven't been formed by American culture in the way that everybody else has. And I think that I have a different kind of intuition than the one described by Truman. And that's why people should listen to me as opposed to other people, about what they should do with their lives. So anyway, maybe I will try to work out a story based on the plot of Love Actually, as if it's the church. Oh, there's a dog. Hello, dog. He's very sad. And and now he's shaking and whining. So I really do think I should start a life coaching company where I tell people
how to live their lives.
Because, I mean, what I like about Truman's book is this idea of intuition. You know, it's not a Holy Spirit intuition or a divine intuition. It's a cultural intuition that we all share.
Right.
And I don't share everybody else's cultural intuition.
You don't have the same social imaginary.
Yeah, I have a different social imaginary. Mine is formed by scripture. And I really do say that without too much guile. I've read the Bible a lot. I have a social imaginary put in place by scripture. So people should listen to me and my intuition. I just wanted to say that again. Nobody does, but everybody should.
Because yours is the one that's rightly formed.
Yeah. So that's my hot take.
You should write an article about this Love Actually. And
well, I want to find a screen, like the scene, so that I can map my Church Actually plot onto the Love Actually plot. That's what I want to do.
Church Actually.
Because I have all these characters that I've been sketching out, and I just don't know which. I don't know how to make a plot. But I think from Love Actually, the point is that you don't have to have a plot. That's my takeaway.
You just weave together different stories.
Yeah.
It's about story.
And then they all end up at the airport at the end. So I thought they could all end up in like the parish hall or church picnic or something.
Okay, that sounds kind of interesting. You can do that.
So, yeah. Well, I think we should go along with our lives because we can't help Disney. And we actually can't be anyone's life coach. So we should go on our walk and hope for the best.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, thank you so much for listening, and maybe we'll be back next week.